welcome to the AI Minds podcast. This is a podcast where we explore the companies of tomorrow being built AI first. I'm your host, Dimitri Ost, and this episode is brought to you by DeepGram, the number one speech-to-text and text-to-speech API on the internet today, trusted by the world's top conversational AI leaders, startups, and enterprises like Spotify, Twilio, NASA, and Citibank. We are joined by none other than the co-founder and CEO of Clinical Notes AI, Ross. How you doing today, man?
Great. Good morning.
Well, I know you're on a whole different side of the globe. We were just talking about how you're in sunny San Diego right now and you got done with a workout. And so I appreciate you making time for me to chat a little bit more about your story and what you've gotten up to. You have a really fascinating journey. And it starts in the cybersecurity sector. Can you break down what you were doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when the mortgage industry crashed back in 2008 and 2009, we said, what are we going to do? So essentially, there was a little startup named iBoss out of San Diego, California. They had about six employees. And I came on really as the first salesperson there. And got introduced to technology. So that's, you know, really where I got my journey started and got my taste of, you know, an IP network table and what the heck that was and what was Active Directory. That was, you know, quite a new world for me early on in my career.
Excellent. And so then you said, all right, 2008, I'm going to try and get a sales job. I imagine that did well for you. You learned a lot about the tech and then you kept going deeper and deeper.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was so overwhelmed, you know, with what I didn't know that I really just dove in to learn how networks functioned, learn how cybersecurity worked. And you know, we got into protecting kids online by blocking them from getting access to pornography at the network level. So that really started my journey into, like, you know, behavioral health tech, but cybersecurity as well. So it was something that was quite interesting that helped people, but and kept kids safe online, but also is technically very interesting.
I'm sure there was a lot of very frustrated 16-year-old boys out there because of what you were doing.
People asked me, they said, what do you do? I said, I ruined 14-year-old boys' dreams.
That's, poor guys, but it's also good. So break down this whole like behavioral tech idea and then where that took you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we were pretty early on at iBoss and, you know, within a couple of years, we became the market share leader in, you know, blocking students from getting to inappropriate content to keep them safe online. And ultimately that turned into even being able to see what kids could type in or typing into Google. And we started seeing, you know, children that were at risk from a self-harm perspective. So it started to really go that direction. And then we took on, you know, some capital from Goldman Sachs and, you know, the company started to go more towards enterprise. And from there, you know, I got a phone call from a little company out of Australia that was really focused on, you know, protecting kids online and, you know, giving parents the ability to, you know, have some control over, you know, how often their kids use the internet, what applications they use, that type of a thing. And we started positioning that with schools. So that was a role where I led North America. I was actually the first employee in North America. And we grew that company from $1 million to about a little over $100 million in 5 years in revenue. And that was quite a journey, to say the least. I learned a lot. We hired a lot. We acquired companies. We raised a bunch of capital. And I really cut my teeth at that particular role.
So you saw the pains of scaling a company. What are some big takeaways that you now are implementing in your current role?
Well, ultimately being customers obsessed and problem obsessed, right? You know, as you see problems, you know, in the market, you know, rather than coming up with our own ideas and pushing them out to the market, it's really about learning exactly how your customer and ideal user lives their day, you know, their day to day inside of their particular role and what matters to them. And then really understanding their problems and aligning the technology there. you know, when you can do that and communicate that story, you're partnering with them, right? You're not really selling anything, if you will. And then while that's happening, preparing the organization for the level of scale, right? You know, taking the amount of having the big dream and the vision to, you know, dominating your market and solving, you know, the problem collectively for your entire space, and preparing your organization to say, hey, if we get, you know, 10 million users, what does that look like? Right. And things that you do with 1 million users and 10 million users fundamentally have to be written in a different way. Right. So really preparing the organization and being customer obsessed.
Are there things that you recognize you needed to be focused on in different stages? I like this idea of really thinking big to try and expand the mind and expand the vision. But I imagine, like, on the organizational level, when you're at 1 million and you're the only person in the US, going from 1 million to 10 million has its unique challenges. Then 10 million to 50 million has its unique challenges. And then 50 to 100 plus are whole different challenges and bottlenecks. So anything that stood out for you in each of these different phases?
Yeah, to get to the next phase, right? As you're reaching up that cliff to grab onto that next rock and throw your leg over the branch and get up there, you have to do things that aren't scalable at first, right? You know, you have to ultimately, you know, maybe lose on your first couple of deals to get there and really learn what that next level is like. And set that expectation really with your customers, you know, as you grow. But, you know, also preparing your team. I think that's incredibly important to say, you know, hey, we're rapidly growing. You may have to wear some hats that, you know, aren't in your exact and perfect job description, but that's part of the fun. And really just smelling the roses along the journey, because you're going to trip and fall and scrape your elbow. And preparing your customers, your team, your staff, and letting them know it's okay to make a mistake, so that, because, you know, they're going to happen, they're going to learn from, but that, you know, really helps breed the and set a culture of innovation across your organization when people feel like they're okay to try things, right? As long as those expectations are there for your customers and your team, it's a really fun journey. So that's, you know, that's it. Have fun and, you know, really try things, from the smart people that you've hired, allow them to make those decisions and try.
I really like this idea of, on those first few deals that you're going for, where you're trying to level up, you should be okay with losing as long as you're learning along the way. And it makes me instantly think, like, how do you have enough conviction in yourself or your product to know that, okay, it's our product's good, or whatever we're learning along the way, we're tweaking it and we're making those changes, but we have the conviction in ourselves to be able to get to that next level.
Right. Yeah, that's really exactly it. And, you know, we even, because we're transparent with that process, you know, when I was at Linewise, which was the student safety company I was most recently at, you know, we got into the biggest deal that we had ever been at. I think it was 75,000 users, you know, at 7 gigabits per second. That they were on demand from a bandwidth perspective. And we struggled there, right? But we learned a lot. We broke our appliance. We took their network down, you know, and ultimately, you know, we lost the proof of concept, but we built a relationship with that CIO. First of all, he said, you know, I need to move to something a bit more stable. And that was fine. And we understood it. But he said our support and our effort and our attention to detail was better than he's ever seen. And he ended up referring multiple other large organizations to us that we, you know, we took the learnings from his organization, applied them there. And ultimately, I think, you know, 2.5 years later, we won him back as a customer. So, you know, you live to fight another day, you take your, you know, your lumps and you learn from those, right? It builds character.
Incredible. So then walk me through the next phase of your journey.
Yeah. So one of the things we designed at Linewise was an AI-based tool that looked for early indicators of suicide, school violence, sexually abused children, substance use disorder in kids. by monitoring network traffic and what was going into the device, where, you know, we found early indicators of that. We ranked them from an AI perspective. And then when there was, you know, a significant potential, you know, issue that was coming up, we would call the school counselor, call the school principal, et cetera. And sometimes, in some cases, we even thwarted some school violent events where our weapons were found in backpacks. It was incredible. Now, and very meaningful. Now, how did I get into Clinical Notes AI? Well, there was a problem with some school districts we work with. So, for example, we deployed that application to a large school district in Southern California. And ultimately, after a month of a trial, they said, we're not buying, turn it off. And we said, we looked at our logs, we said, well, why? They we thwarted, you know, four different suicidal events in children. And, you know, we're keeping kids safe in your district. And they said, look, our behavioral health staff is so overwhelmed that we cannot handle the amount of alerts that are coming in. So from a liability perspective, we cannot have these things sitting in our inbox. So turn it off.
Oh, no.
And that really kept me up at night, right? And as it kept me up at night, I thought about it and started interviewing some of those counselors, some of those, you know, principals, and talked to the CIO offline. He's like, if we would, we could. He's like, but our legal team said we can't. So as I interviewed them, I asked them, if I could give you a magic wand and you could make one thing go away, what would it be? And they said, my notes and my documentation take up so much of my time. And as we estimated that, we looked at it and started researching. It's about 30, anywhere from 20 to 35%, average is 30.
What are these notes and documentation? What does this look like? What is that like?
Yeah, so every meeting that they have in certain schools and in behavioral health departments, especially if they're billing insurance, they have to create a treatment plan. They have to create a progress note. They have to do an assessment on them, and then they have to do kind of a final discharge type of a document. So the treatment plans will take them 30 to 45 minutes a kid or a patient. The progress notes on average is about 15 minutes after every single patient or student that they see. And if you think about, you know, the amount of time that adds up, if they're seeing 6, 7, 8, you know, clients or students a day, which is about 30% of the time, how many more children could they help, right? Suicide is the number two cause of death for people under 24. It's horrible. And, you know, we have even internally have an experience with that. So, you know, when I left my previous organization, we founded this. I founded this with the clinical psychologist out of Australia. Her name was Jordan Foster. She won Businesswoman of the Year in 2020. We had actually acquired her business in Australia. And she was a very dear friend to me and co-founder in this business. And right before we actually launched our product, we actually lost her to mental health. So, you know, her legacy is with us, and we're building this in her honor. And in the honor for the mental health of behavioral health clinicians. Not a lot of people think about, how is my doctor's mental health? How is my therapist's mental health? Because they're helping me. They should be fine. Well, they're not. And a major burden for them is their administrative duties. And they're carrying everybody else's burdens as they're helping people as well. So it's a tough role. And most technology is built to give them more work. There's not a lot that's built to reduce the administrative burden on their plate to help them. So that's what we've built.
Wow. So first off, really sorry to hear that. And it's a very difficult situation. As you mentioned, most of the time when we go to our therapist, it's very much like, at least when I'm going, it's like me. Type thing. I'm not sitting there asking my therapist, like, so how are you doing? Right. And tell me what's on your mind. And so I see that what you're talking about. And it is like, there is a weight that can be carried silently, because sometimes I imagine it's hard as a therapist to speak about this stuff because you're the one who's supposed to be keeping everybody else up. and making everybody else feel good. And so that's very rough to hear about, but you continued to interview people and you continued to say, what is it about this? Like, if we could get rid of this documentation and this writing that you need to do, and we could save you 15 minutes per kid that you see, at the end of the day, if you tally that up, that's like a couple hours worth of documentation that they have to do. And so out of that, Clinical Notes was born. Is that how it
works? Yeah, absolutely. So with the magic wand statement, we said, okay, generative AI was very new. And we knew the summarization capabilities of it. And we knew, you know, Llama 2 had just come out, just released it open source. Hugging Face was there. You know, there were some models that were available, but also some off-the-shelf stuff too that was decent. So, you know, we ultimately built an MVP, very small, you know, in the cloud, in partnership with DeepGram, in partnership with, you know, OpenAI, right? I think everybody was touching that, and our own model really as well. And we put it together and pushed it out to the counselors at that particular school district, actually. And they started using it and said, where has this been my entire life? This is changing my life. And then we knew that we found a problem that we could solve. So it was very exciting. And the first day we rolled it out to them, we had 24 mental health clinicians sign up for it. And we were, jumping up, high-fiving, excited. They started using the product. And then they started sharing it with their clinical friends that were outside of public sector. So they started sharing it with other behavioral health clinics, and then they were reaching out to us and asking us if they could use it for free. And we're like, okay, this is starting to go well. Let's let this fire burn. So it really started to go viral in the Southern California behavioral health kind of industry, if you will. And then we said, all right, well, let's build this puppy for scale. So, mm-hmm. With our experience of, previously, building a company up to, serving over 13 million daily average users, we started to build our infrastructure. And, we can look around corners with some of that. So, that was how Clinical Notes AI was born. And we continued to, get additional MVPs, deployments, and, scale the product. It took us around, 4 months to actually build the product until we were ready for GA. And then, we added pricing in and hooked it up to Stripe, created some automation there. And we actually launched the product GA on January 22nd of 2024.
And have you noticed that it is mainly word of mouth that's been the reason for the growth?
Well, yes, and some influencers really as well, which I guess is technically word of mouth too. So essentially we had what kicked us off really, and we built a dual go-to-market model, which I'll get into in just a minute. But what kicked us off really was an influencer on YouTube that only talks about clinical documentation for therapists. I mean, how perfect of an influencer had found our product, reached out to us for a demo. And she said, by the way, I have a YouTube channel with 29,000 mental health, behavior health specialists that I talk about notes with. Can I do a review on your product? What did I tell her, you think? absolutely. I said, can we do a rev share or some note? I do not take any type of compensation at all. I just want to review your product. So she did a review and then boom, it exploded, from there. And we created a referral program as well. And that's part of our kind of individual and small group practitioner approach. But we have a dual go-to-market approach as well for the enterprise, which we're doing really well in too.
And is it, as you mentioned, there's been this time-saving aspect. I imagine you're getting people that are reaching out to you saying, like, I'm able to see X amount of more students. Is that like the main value prop that you're saying? Like, you can now see more patients because of all this paperwork that gets cut out.
Well, here's the thing. In behavioral health, people get into it because they care about people. So that's instant problem, right? Not to mention the you know, the mental health of the clinicians, which we'll get into in a second. But then we go, okay, we show the demo, we talk about it, and we go, how much time do we think that AI could shave off of their note and documentation time? See, if I say it, it's suspect, if they say it, it's true. So they go, well, shoot, about 40% usually is what they say. Our reports are showing about 60, but we go, okay, let's go with 40. All right, so if you're at 1.4 million, right, and it's 40, that's $600,000, you know, dollars plus a year. If you can shave that off, well, what's the cost of our product? A little bit less than that. No. So the ROI is really there from a business sense perspective. And then just the lives of the people.
Yeah, it's super clear if you can put it in those types of numbers, because someone is like, and it's not like, as you mentioned, the clinician isn't stoked to be doing paperwork, I imagine. There's not really a lot of people that get out of bed and think like, wow, I hope I can do more paperwork today than I did yesterday, right?
Yeah.
There's that whole side of it where you get to empower people to do what they do best and let the bureaucracy part of it kind of go under the hood. And so can you break down how exactly it works? Are people just recording conversations with their phone in the in their like, what is it called, when they see a patient? Or like, what does it actually look like to get the documentation done for you, or have a co-pilot doing the documentation with you?
So there's a couple of ways that we do capture, right? It's all about how do you get the AI, the data, to be able to help you, okay? So we offer a live option to where the AI actually listens to the conversation live, and then takes that transcript that's built, submits it to one of our microservice multi-LLM infrastructure. And then from there, it does the summarization, it does a potential diagnosis, et cetera, and contextualizes things out of that transcript through a trained and fine-tuned LLM that's designed to write clinical documentation that aligns with insurance reimbursement for them. So they talk about, you know, hey, I got a new cat yesterday, right? That's not going to be in the conversation. It's only going to be what's clinically relevant. So that's option one. Option two is talk to your AI scribe. So we call ourselves a therapeutic scribe. So we actually are using DeepGram to speak to the actual clinician to where they can have a conversation. It says, describe your session for me. They'll go ahead and describe what happened in their session, how their client presented, any assessments they did. And then the AI will actually ask questions to them. And then when they answer those, it'll then take that information, transcript again, and do the same thing, create a note or a document. So really, in this space, it's all about informed consent and the client being aware that AI is being used to listen to the conversation, right? It's very sensitive information, even more so than medical PHI, right? You may not care if it gets out that somebody knows how many, you know, what your T cell count is in your blood, but you're going to care if you tell somebody a very deep, dark, traumatic story of some level of abuse you've experienced or a marital conflict or those types of things. So highly sensitive. So we give those different types of options to our customers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then, wow. So let me just try and summarize everything here, because it feels like this is very cool. What you've been able to do is you said, okay, you have two options. You can have it there with you, and then it will help whatever the paperwork is after the fact, or you can be prompted, and then you as the clinician can talk about what you just went through and what you were talking about and all of that fun stuff. Because I imagine some people aren't super excited to have their conversations being recorded when it is this sensitive.
And that's a key factor and strategy we actually made. So we use the speech to text, you know, technology through partnering with DeepGram. And then from there, that audio is discarded immediately. It can't be subpoenaed. It can't be pulled. The transcript that we get out of that, we use just enough to create the document or the note. And then that is disassociated as well. So we put all of that in our privacy policy. We have scripts for clinicians to read to patients. And there's generally a fear of that up front. but it's all about the delivery for them. And we get a lot of feedback from our customers that I'm surprised that all of my customers are okay with this. And people are actually intrigued with it, you know, especially because it helps their clinician.
Well, Ross, this is super cool to see, and I'm very excited for what you're doing. It is, as you mentioned, AI for good in a way. And so I wanted to talk a bit about that theme and the narrative right now, the general narrative is that like AI is going to come, it's going to take our jobs, it's going to destroy everything. Feels like you've really found a way to leverage what we are capable of doing today, not some far-fetched story in the future, right? Not like some fantasy or sci-fi book that may or may not happen. You said, what can we do today to help people's lives be better? And let's do it. Let's put it into practice. Let's see how well it works and let's see how people respond to that.
I mean, AI for good is such a good theme and hashtag, frankly, right? I think, you know, we could go out and use our minds to create an application that uses AI to help you trade stocks better. And those are out there and those are great, right? But, you know, what's the purpose of really why we're here? And is to really care about other people, right? And to build relationships. So it actually does the opposite of, I think, what a lot of people think it does. Right. It's going to take my job. You know, people are going to be lazy, you know, et cetera. That's not the case. Humans are tool builders. Right. You know, I think there was a study done, you know, back in the 80s. And I think it was in Popular Mechanics where it ranked the animals versus, you know, the humans. And the humans were ranked, I think, 9th or 10th in that particular study on their own from speed, from efficiency, et cetera. But then they looked at, they recalibrated that with a human on a bike. And the human on the bike was number one by far, right? We are tool builders. What we've done here with AI is build a tool to help humans be more efficient. Look at all the different medicines that can come out of this. Look at how many more diseases can be detected. Look at how much time it can save so that, you know, clinicians can build better relationships with their patients so that they can focus on their families and not do notes and documentation on weekends, right? It's making us much more efficient from a content creation perspective. There's so many millions of new problems that AI can help humans solve so that they can focus on their family, so they can focus on their wives and their husbands and their relationships to free up the time that we would spend nights and weekends maybe, you know, writing that white paper or writing that documentation. So AI for good, to really help the people who help people, is what we're focused on. And I think it's really important that we get the word out about that, because, you know, a lot of fear just comes from ignorance, which is just a lack of knowledge. And, you know, as we explain and show people how it's making their lives better, they feel good about using AI and they know they're using it really in the right way.
Of course. Excellent, Ross. Well, I'm very excited for everything that you've got coming and what you are doing. I appreciate you coming on here and exploring and talking about your journey with us and everything that you're doing with Clinical Notes.
Thanks, Demetrius, for having me on. And it's always a pleasure to connect with you. And hopefully we can do it again soon.